Call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 4th, 2016. Let the record reflect the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Coghill, Senator Stoltz, and Senator Stedman. I expect Senator Costello along shortly. Senator Michicki is tied up with Senate Finance Committee meeting right now. Thank you to Kelly and to Ben who are helping us keep the minutes and with the audio. I will invite the House Resource Chairman, or Co-Chairman, Representative Benny Inagiak, to introduce the House members who are present.
Oh, thank you. I'm Ben Inagiak. I'm Co-Chair House Resources. And to my right is Representative Tarariku. I'm Co-Chair with in the House side of Resources. And over there is Representative Seaton. And I think behind me is Representative Josephson, and I'll introduce them. I'm Representative Heron, is here, and thank you for inviting us, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. It is a privilege to have the House Resources Committee joining us today. So for today's hearing, we're going to take up a presentation by the Cohen Group's report on the EPA's action in connection with a Bristol Bay watershed. But I want to tell you something ahead of time for the record. Today's hearing is about a federal process that falls under the Environmental Protection Agency. In the past 5 years, the state of Alaska has had significant federal restrictions and challenges to our ability to support the people of Alaska through the abundant resources this land holds. Some examples: the Department of Interior is blocking our efforts to construct a public safety road through a wildlife refuge in southwest Alaska. Some examples from the EPA related to water and air quality: the Clean Air Act challenges our energy sources from coal. We have been temporarily given a, air quotes, breather on those air quality rules, but we do anticipate the Clean Power Act regulations will be enacted on us sometime in the future. The Clean Water Act, under that, the EPA has promulgated a rule called the Waters of the U.S., which would place virtually the entire state under the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act and the EPA. Thankfully, the U.S. Supreme Court has put a stay on enforcement of those rules at this time. What we're going to be talking about today is the actions of the EPA. This hearing today is not about the merits of a mining project. I'm going to repeat that in case you were thinking about where you're going to eat dinner tonight. Today's hearing is not about the merits of a specific mining project. The hearing is about one of the many federal regulatory processes under which Alaska has to function. So, thank you so much to General Joseph Ralston, Vice Chair of the Cohen Group. Thank you for presenting today. I'll let you identify yourself for the record and the colleague that you've brought with you, and then proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and to Chairman Giesel, to Chairman Inagiak and Tarariku, and to members of the Senate and House Resources Committee. My name is Joseph Ralston, and with me is Holly Butler from the DLA legal group in Washington, D.C. I'm here to testify on Secretary Cohen's independent review of the EPA's decision-making process regarding the potential mining in the Bristol Bay watershed. Let me start by saying that I've been an Alaska resident since 1992, and I spent several years at Elmendorf when I commanded the Alaskan Command. In 2003, when I left active duty, my wife and I returned to Alaska, where we have lived full-time in Anchorage since that time. So I am fully aware and appreciate the complexities and the views of Alaskans with regard both pro and con to the Pebble Mine. And as you, Madam Chairman, said, this is not about the Pebble Mine, and neither was Secretary Cohen's review. The review was to review the actions of the EPA as a federal agency. Secretary Cohen and I have spent most of our professional lives in the service of our country. For the Secretary, as a congressman, as a senator, and Secretary of the largest department of the executive branch, in my own 38 years of service in the Air Force, we both feel very strongly that federal agencies have an obligation to act in a fair manner. This is the only way they can maintain the trust of the American people. I will summarize the basis under which the review was undertaken, the process used, and the findings. First, with conditions of acceptance. Secretary Cohen was first approached by Tom Collier of the Pebble Partnership in the fall of 2014. Pebble expressed concern about the fairness of EPA's decision-making process in connection with EPA's evaluation of potential mining in Bristol Bay, and he wanted an objective party to examine that concern. After examining a wide range of documents, including those obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, the Secretary determined that sufficient and legitimate questions existed as to the fairness of the EPA's process and agreed to undertake this review, assisted by his team at the Cohen Group and the law firm DLA Piper. One of the lead counselors on this review, Ms. Holly Butler, is here with me today. The Secretary conditioned his acceptance on complete independence. The Pebble Limited Partnership had no ability to edit or censor his views. The conclusions he drew were his and his alone. The Pebble Limited Partnership compensated our team according to commercially standard terms, and no portion of this compensation was contingent upon the result or the content of the report. The Secretary did not make a determination on whether a mine should be built. That is a question for engineers, scientists, and the state of Alaska. Nor did he comment on the legality of EPA's preemptive use of Section 404C of the Clean Water Act. This is a question for the courts and for congressional review. Given his substantial executive and legislative experience, Secretary Cohen felt qualified and agreed to review the process by which EPA assessed and proposed restrictions to reduce the environmental risk associated with potential mining in the Bristol Bay watershed from the perspective of a cabinet official. On the process of review, the Cohen Group team had unfettered access to and conducted a thorough examination of the extensive written record of more than 42,000 documents produced by federal agencies in response to Freedom of Information Act requests, including EPA, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, and NOAA. We also reviewed documents from the state of Alaska, EPA's own published record of its process, congressional hearings, and Pebble Partnership. We welcome the opportunity to speak with anyone who cared to share with us their perspective on this important topic, and we made every effort to seek out and speak with as many people representing as many different points of view as we could. Over 60 people representing all points of view on EPA's actions, pro, against, and neutral, voluntarily spoke with the Secretary and our team. This included three former EPA administrators and several former EPA assistant administrators for water from both Democratic and Republican administrations, as well as members of Alaska's native tribes from the Bristol Bay region, scientists both opposed to and in support of the mine, former Alaska government officials, and representatives of the Pebble Partnership. We also visited the region, including the Pebble deposit site. EPA, through the Justice Department, declined Secretary Cohen's request to making current personnel available for interviews, citing ongoing congressional and, at the time, the Inspector General inquiries and pending litigation. We recognized and can appreciate this decision. With regard to findings, the Pebble deposit is a mineral deposit located in the Bristol Bay watershed. The deposit has been described by the Alaska Department of Natural Resources as one of the world's largest copper resources. It is located on lands owned by the state of Alaska, which have been designated for mineral exploration and development under an area plan for state lands. The Bristol Bay watershed is largely undisturbed by significant development. The economy is dominated by commercial salmon fishing and features a native Alaskan population that maintains a strong salmon-centered culture and subsistence-based lifestyle. Thus, any regulatory authority to be exercised requires the most fair and appropriate process, particularly as it interacts with the state of Alaska, the landowner in this case. Here, EPA did not employ the well-established permit NEPA process to evaluate potential development in the Bristol Bay watershed. Rather, EPA used Section 404C of the Clean Water Act to preemptively impose restrictions on potential mining in the area. Because to date, the Pebble Partnership has not submitted a permit application, EPA relied on hypothetical scenarios for its Bristol Bay watershed assessment rather than the characteristics of a mine that could actually be proposed to be built and maintained. EPA failed to address important considerations that would be included in the NEPA process, including meaningful participation by the state of Alaska and other federal government agencies, mitigation and controls as proposed by the developer, and an array of public interest factors. The NEPA process has been used for decades and has been widely endorsed by environmental groups as being, quote, democratic at its core, unquote. EPA relied upon the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment in its proposed determination, but acknowledged that there were significant gaps in its assessment and that it was not designed to duplicate or replace the NEPA process. EPA's unprecedented preemptive use of Section 404C inhibited the involvement of two key participants, the state of Alaska and the Army Corps of Engineers. These observations informed the Secretary's conclusion that EPA's application of Section 404C prior to the filing of a permit application was not fair to all stakeholders. The fairest and most appropriate process to evaluate possible development in the Pebble Deposit area would use the established regulatory NEPA process to assess a mine permit application rather than using an assessment based upon the hypothetical mining scenarios described in the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment as the basis for imposing prohibitive restrictions on future mines. The NEPA process is more comprehensive than the preemptive Section 404C process employed here. EPA conceded in comments to peer reviewers that there were gaps in its assessment that would be addressed during a NEPA process. Here, as the agency acknowledges, EPA initiated Section 404C in an unprecedented manner. EPA's use of Section 404C before a permit application filing exacerbated the shortcomings of the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment noted by the state of Alaska, several peer reviewers, and the Pebble Partnership. Most notably, the use of hypothetical assumptions that may not accurately or fairly represent an actual project, and the failure to take into account mitigation and control techniques required by the state or that a developer might propose. Stakeholders disagree about the legality of EPA's preemptive use of Section 404C. An environmental impact assessment is bound to provide more accurate information if it analyzes a mine that would be built in accordance with the developer's plans rather than a hypothetical mine plan, which even EPA acknowledges is likely to be different from a developer-submitted plan. This project is too important for all stakeholders to pilot a new, untested decision-making process. The fairest approach is to use the well-established NEPA process, and Secretary Cohen could find no valid reason why that process was not used. During the course of his review, statements and actions of EPA personnel have raised questions about EPA's motives. Although Secretary Cohen found many troubling questions, he did not attempt to reach any conclusions on these issues and instead urged those with subpoena power to pursue this incomplete record. The EPA Inspector General recently released a report of its investigation. The IG report, however, addressed only one component of the broader process by which EPA determined it would propose restrictions on mining in the Pebble Deposit area and did not address the fairness of EPA's novel application of Section 404C. As a result of this narrow scope, the IG report did not provide any information that directly addresses Secretary Cohen's findings, including his central finding that the fairest and most appropriate process to evaluate any development in the Pebble Deposit area would use the established regulatory permit NEPA process to assess a mine permit application. The IG report left open many questions and presented an incomplete record in material aspects. Thus, we believe there remain troubling aspects that merit review by those who have the constituted responsibility to take a deeper look, be it in Congress, the courts, or the administration. Again, this is not about pro-Pebble or anti-Pebble, but rather good governance and the actions of our federal agencies and processes by which they interact with their state partners and constituencies. how EPA conducted the process to assess potential development and protect our fish and our environment here in Alaska is of vital importance to our state, to our region, and our country. Madam Chair, Chairman Nagiak and Tallarico, thank you again for providing me the opportunity to brief your respective committees on the results of the Secretary's review on this important question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, General Ralston. For the record, I wanted to note that Representative Craig Johnson has been with us for about 10 minutes, and welcome to Representative Tarr as well. Any questions for General Ralston from the Senate Committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. So you stated that the fairest and most appropriate process to evaluate the possible development would be the NEPA process. Is there anything that has stopped the Pebble Partnership from applying for a permit?
Currently, because of the injunction and the ongoing process and the EPA's statements that they would not grant a permit during the process of the 404C issues, that is one reason why they haven't. From the COIN group did not look at why or why not the Pebble has not submitted a permit. I think that would be an appropriate question for Mr. Collier.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
What was how much compensation has the COIN group received from Pebble Partnership or their affiliates?
As a matter of policy, we do not release what our clients pay us for service, other than to say that it was standard commercially terms.
Follow-up?
Is it possible to get a copy of the contract that you had with the Pebble Partnership for the, so we can figure out what the compensation rates were?
Our policy is that we do not disclose the confidential information between our clients and the COIN group.
Follow-up.
I saw that D.L. Piper is an organization that helped in the preparation of this document, and in doing some research for this, I read that there's a senior partner of D.L. Piper named Stuart B. Morrow, and is he a partner of D.L. Piper?
He is a partner in our Canadian
office. Please identify yourself for the record.
Excuse me. This is Holly Butler of DLA Piper, and the person about whom you're referring, I believe, is Mr. Morrow, who is a partner of DLA Piper's Canada office.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
I don't know if this is him or not, but there's a filing with the British Columbia Securities Commission that shows that Mr. Morrow backed a $3.5 million stake in Northern Dynasty Minerals about 40 days before the issuance of this report. Is that the same Mr. Morrow who works for D.L. Piper?
Mr. Morrow, on behalf of a firm client, opened up a company and established a company for deposit of stock. Mr. Morrow holds no interest and did not facilitate the purchase of any Northern Dynasty stock. No one at DLA Piper US or Canada holds any interest whatsoever in stock for Pebble, Northern Dynasty, Hunter Dickinson, or any of its affiliates. It has no financial or business relationships with that company.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions from senators? Seeing none, House members, questions? Representative Josephson.
Madam Chair, can I remain seated?
Yes, absolutely, sir.
The conclusion of the COIN report on page 82, I apologize for you're having to turn around. Page 82 states the EPA's decision to propose allowable standards for the amount of harm to salmon habitat that EPA would accept was founded on an analysis of hypothetical scenarios in the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment, which you've been arguing, rather than actual mine permit application. And my question is, if that's true, why is it necessary to have an application in order for EPA to set those standards? Why can't the standards stand alone, as it were?
Mr. Jodison, I think our response to that would be that EPA should wait for a description of whatever the project's going to be, whatever the mine would be, whatever mitigation measures would be proposed, before they can hypothetically come up with what they think might be the mine.
And so we think the fairest process is to, let's wait, let's see what the permit says, and then take whatever actions are necessary.
Further questions from House members? All right, seeing none. Oh, Senator Coghill.
General, thank you very much for your work and for your group. Has there been anywhere close to this type of permitting that has excluded such large stakeholders such as the Corps of Engineers and the State of Alaska in any other place in the United States?
What Secretary Cohen and his team concluded is that this is an unprecedented action. At no time has the EPA ever tried to invoke Section 404C in the absence of a permit being filed. There have been occasions where permits have been filed and they have invoked Section 404C. There was one occasion in Florida where there were three parcels of land co-located. Two of them had a permit filed. The third one had not yet filed a permit, but it was going to be the same as the other two, and in that case, the EPA invoked Section 404C. But in the case that we're talking about here, this would be unprecedented, and the EPA admits it would be unprecedented. And part of the problem that we get into, this could establish a precedent where the EPA could go to not only the state of Alaska's lands, but any landholder, any property owner, private property, and preemptively say you can't build a fish pond if that's what you wanted to do, even though you hadn't filed a permit.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
So was this done with any pre-plan? Was there any recommendations from the Secretary? Were there any recommendations to Congress on taking this kind of action, or was it generated without comment?
Part of the problem that we did not have access to EPA personnel because the EPA says, no, you can't talk to our personnel. We do believe these are very troubling issues that need to be looked at. There was an absence, for example, of 25 months of emails by the person on the ground who was involved in this project because his computer broke or he used his personal computer in violation of the law. EPA's IG, for example, said that they called it possible misuse of position, unquote. And Secretary Cohen recommended that those people with subpoena power, i.e. the courts, the Congress of the United States, or the IG, should in fact look deeper into this process.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
Thank you. And it's my understanding that one of the primary investigators that EPA used actually fled the United States and was unable to be sequestered by any government official at this point.
My understanding is the individual in questions you referred to is Mr. Phil North, who was an EPA employee. He retired about 3 years ago. He did leave the United States. He refused to accept subpoenas from the Congress of the United States. My understanding is that he may be returning to the United States, and this is where we hope people with subpoena power can get to the bottom of what all was going on.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
The fairness question is certainly a clear question to us in Alaska because of the precious nature of the land. It's not contiguous in so many places, but it looked like a whole watershed had been brought to bear rather than just a permitted area. In your investigation, how close did it track what was going to be proposed over against a watershed that was much broader?
You know, I'm unable to answer the question, Senator, because I don't know what a proposed public mine would be. It hasn't been filed. And so until that action takes place, we're all speculating on what it might be. And so I have no opinion on that because I haven't seen that.
And that was an unfair question, but it needed to be brought to light.
Yes,
that
sir.
The application process has been thwarted on every account, and on this particular case was even stopped from getting to any maturity. So, and that was to the senator to the right that was suggesting that they could go ahead and permit anyway. but they were too blocked in my view. So I found that very unfortunate that we couldn't even get a legitimate proposal on table.
Yes, Representative Herron has a question, General Ralston. He's going to come up here, so.
General, good to see you again. I guess I appreciate that we're not talking about the issue, the debate whether Pebbles is should go forward or not, but it is about individuals in the government doing things that obviously corrupted a process. And the Madam Chair, she mentioned the Eisenbeck hit road issue, and it's my belief, I'm convinced of it, is that after the EIS was concluded and the EIS recommended that the road would go through, it went back to D.C. and unfortunately was corrupted by someone. So what I listened very carefully and read your comments is that what we have? Is we have an individual that has corrupted a very thorough process?
Sir, I think I would say this. These are some of the troubling questions that Secretary Cohen uncovered. And let me use as an example, and let me refer to my own opinion now. According to the IG who looked at this, Mr. North, who has been out of the country for 3 years, refused to accept subpoenas by the Congress of the United States, and they say, quote, possible misuse of position, unquote. In my years in the Defense Department, if we encountered something like this and the IG came to us and said this individual has misused their position, we would recall that person to active duty. We would do an investigation, and if it determined that they in fact had misused their position, they would be demoted to the last time they successfully performed in their duties, and their retirement pay would be adjusted accordingly. The IG report sort of dismissed it. Well, yes, possible misuse of position, but he's retired, and all we'll do is send a letter out to our employees saying, be ethical in your procedures. Well, to me, that's not accountability.
Follow-up, Representative Herron?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I might just one more.
Yes. Before I call on you, Senator Coghill, I want to thank Senator Huggins for joining us. Senator Coghill.
There's so many areas I'd like to ask about, but one of the things that we have depended upon on both sides of the aisle and in all the contentious issues that we've dealt with is the Freedom of Information Act. That is one way that we can ask how is our government officials performing, what's going on behind the scenes. And I think many of us have been even made to produce things because of a Freedom of Information Act. What was the use of that in putting this document together? Was it helpful? Is there reasons it couldn't be used, or was it used?
The Freedom of Information Act was used. As I said, over 42,000 documents were reviewed. That's the good news. The bad news is, in the major players' actions here, over 25 months of emails were missing because the computer crashed or he used his personal account, of which the EPA didn't have the passwords for. We don't know what are in those 25 months of missing information that we did file a Freedom of Information Act on, but were unable to get anything back.
Follow-up?
No, just a comment. This seems to be a real problem in governance altogether right now, that we're having convenient computer crashes and missing emails. And this is very troubling to me because it impacts Alaska so broadly and so deeply that a key player would somehow have lost all that information. So I just found it very troubling, that's all.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Did the Cohen Group disclose the names or affiliations of the people who were solicited to participate in this report?
We interviewed over 60 people, as I said, and we granted them that we would not release their names in the interest of getting a candid response from them.
Follow-up?
Were preliminary drafts of the report made available to the public or the EPA?
The EPA did receive a copy of the report prior to its publication.
about the public or those who participated in the review?
No.
Was the report subject to peer review?
The report was not a scientific document and therefore was not appropriate to be put out for peer review. I might hypothetically add that I have great respect for Secretary Cohen in the fact of 6 years as a congressman, 18 years as a senator, and Secretary of Defense of the largest department. There are not many peers in that category.
Further questions from House members? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out exactly, you know, why we're here. But looking at the conclusions and observations from the Cohen report, you know, it says that is not, you know, the purpose was not to comment on whether the EPA acted within the scope of its legal rights, and I assume both the EPA had the authority to conduct a study of Bristol Bay watershed, and the EPA may invoke Section 404C at any time. And then I'm trying to figure out, because we have an IG report that I think that you, with the report, as well as the Pebble Partnership, solicited and came through, and its title is EPA Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. Obtainable records show EPA followed required procedures without bias or predetermination, but a possible misuse of position noted. So what are you suggesting that should be done in the case of, you know, not EPA saying the bias was not there or that there was no predetermination?
Yes, sir. With regard to the IG report, what we have said, the IG report was a very narrow report. Why it was so narrow, I'm not sure. Whether they were overworked, they didn't have time to do it. But, for example, they only started in 2008, not when their idea came up of the 404C investment, and they stopped it at 2012, 2 years prior to the end of their process. So why did the IG only look at a discrete section of time? And an important word that you said there was according to obtainable records. Well, part of this was they couldn't obtain the records for 25 months of the people who were heavily involved in this that involved the possible misuse of position. Those are the things that the Cohen Group recommended, that those people with subpoena power, i.e. the courts, the Congress of the United States, should look into.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I'm just trying to figure out the scope of this, because if we've got a Inspector General report that says there wasn't predetermination or there wasn't bias, and now we're saying, well, there were some records that might not have been available or that weren't available, and therefore something else should happen, but that doesn't override the conclusions that the procedures without bias or predetermination. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out, we can always want more, and is that the point we're at, is we don't like the Inspector General's conclusions and therefore we are saying that we should have more?
I think what the Cohen Group would say with regard to the IG report is, number one, it only dealt in a very narrow piece of it. It did not address the fundamental issue of, was this the fairest process possible? They admit that they were unable to obtain Phil North's emails for 25 months. And by the way, they only looked at email records from three people in the EPA. They did not go outside of that. They did not contact the Corps of Engineers, even though the EPA is mandated to coordinate with the Corps of Engineers. They didn't do that. So we think there are a lot of deficiencies in the IG report that don't really address the major issue.
And if I could in addition to the scope that General Ralston has indicated was restricted in connection with the IG report, there were also a number of questions and concerns that were alluded to in the opening statement that Secretary Cohen raised in the process of his report and investigation that were not addressed in the scope of the IG report, and that bear directly on the integrity of the process, such as the use of hypotheticals, the communications with third-party and anti-mine advocates, as well as the EPA's refusal to accommodate the state of Alaska in connection with several of its specific requests.
Thank you, Ms. Butler. Further questions? Senator Coghill.
So in consultation with the state of Alaska, was there any known consultation with regard to the use of the 404C?
Let me take that and ask Holly to fill on, in on it. The state of Alaska requested many times in writing that they needed more time to address the issues. They needed a permit. All of these were discarded by the EPA and not addressed.
In connection, the state of Alaska voiced concerns at various stages within the process, both at the watershed assessment stage. They asked the EPA to wait, as General Rossin has said, until a permit was filed, and they were asked for an extension of time. On at least one occasion, the state of Alaska was denied an extension of time by the EPA. On other occasions, of course, the EPA refused to wait for the permit to be filed. So the state of Alaska stated they were damned if they do, damned if they don't. We have to participate, or you will say we stood down. And if we do participate, you will say we had our opportunity.
Follow up, Senator Coghill.
See if I can get the question right. I know the state made some contacts. So based on some of the hypothetical issues, but it was a watershed assessment, so what was the science base that they chose to lean on, and what's the credibility of that science base, if at all?
Again, let me make a statement and ask Holly to add to it. But during the peer review, for example, it was several objections raised about how can you do this when you don't know what a proposed mine is. This hypothetical mine may not in any way, shape, or form be what the developer has in mind. And that was many times brought up in the peer review process.
Ms. Butler, additional comments?
Thank you so much. So when the EPA established the parameters of its hypothetical, according to their own documents, they relied in large part on what is referred to as either the Ghaffari report or the Wardrop report. And you see this mentioned again in the IG report that was recently released. However, with the EPA and the IG, they refer to this as, quote, unquote, a preliminary mine plan. However, in the course of our investigation, we called and spoke to Mr. Ghaffari and asked him what the intent of that Ghaffari report was. We were informed that this was in no way a mine plan, preliminary or otherwise. This was a certification that there were minerals and materials in the ground. So in other words, whereas a mine plan is how you get the minerals out, this was saying there were minerals there for investing purposes.
Follow up, Senator Coghill.
And another part of that was, so I'm trying to drill down to find out, did they do any assessing of the waters in Bristol Bay?
There was an assessment conducted. There were debates on both sides as to the validity of that science. Our investigation did not evaluate whose science trumped whose.
So we have an hypothetical with at least a assessment that is under question. And so I suppose for us in Alaska, we should probably pay really close attention to what that assessment actually says for the value to us. Then the last question, this just generates so many interesting questions. The email track with the state of Alaska, light as it may be, at least shows we made some appeals. But it also, you said that there were some appeals to kind of anti-mine environmental groups. Were those able to be traced down, or were those also in the missing email train?
There were some emails that were available, that were reviewed. We don't know what we don't know out of the missing 25 months.
But it was very clearly said that there was some collaboration with groups that had an agenda.
I think that's exactly right. And, for example, one of the things that the EPA is on public record of saying is that they did not start this 404C process until they were asked to do so by the Alaska Native community. We found emails that go back 2 years before that, where Phil North was coordinating with the Natives, writing the letter for them to come to the EPA.
And if I could add.
Yes, Ms. Butler.
With regard to that one instance that General Ralston has referred to, where it was the impetus of the watershed assessment was this letter from the Native Alaskan tribes, that is actually the one instance in the IG report where they found the possible instance of misuse, because the IG letter was actually drafted by an attorney sent to Mr. North, and according to the IG report, Mr. North and this attorney sent emails back and forth revising and drafting the letter. So you have someone from inside the EPA actually facilitating the letter, which became the impetus for the watershed assessment.
Senator Coghill.
And then speaking of compensation, there was certainly a lot of money invested from some of those legal groups to do some of those. Is that a trail that you tried to follow?
We did not.
Okay. I think that's a trail that should be followed.
Welcome, Senator Costello. Further questions? Yes, Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the invited guest. I wanted to follow up on Senator Wilikowski's comment about DLA Piper, this new investor, and ask whether they participated at all in the authoring of the Cohen Report.
Most certainly they did not, and we were unaware of even this corporation being in existence until the day prior to Secretary Cohen's testimony in front of Congress after our report had been released.
May I?
Yes, follow up, Senator Josephson.
As early as a decade ago, during a gubernatorial race that I was following, Knowles versus Palin, pretty well-known race, there was discussion and debate about the SEC filings and sworn statements about what the project would look like. Is it your position that something in the Clean Water Act prohibits some reliance on that sort of data?
I think the Cohen report would say is whatever was in the SEC filing was certainly insufficient and in no way representative of what a mine would be. So it is not the level of detail that you would need in a permit in the SEC report.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Josephson?
Thank you. Is there anything, we've heard the argument about this is the first time that this preemption has been used prior to any issuance of a permit. Is there anything in federal law that prohibits that? Even if it's never been done before, does the law allow for it?
The Cohen Group did not take a position on the legality. We think this is a position for the courts and for the Congress of the United States.
Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Representative Tarr had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things. I guess I haven't heard you comment on what makes this, I think, a unique circumstance also in that local Alaskan communities actually requested the involvement of the EPA. I heard Ms. Butler comment anti-mine. For me, I have a different perspective. If it's Alaska Native tribe, if people who have been here for 10,000 years, I don't question whether they have appropriate sort of standing, if you will, to reach out to the federal government in an area of such great importance. So I wonder if you could both comment on what makes this unique in that the request was actually made from Alaskans for this type of participation. And then also your conclusion in the report is that it'd be most appropriately dealt with through the permitting NEPA process. Nothing's prohibiting Pebble from actually going forward and applying for those permits, and that would actually trigger the NEPA process, and we could get those additional questions answered. But it seems to me that the blame is being placed elsewhere when they've had ample time to put their permit applications in. That would make this all moot point anyhow. So I don't think it's the responsibility of us to figure out why they haven't made the business decision to move forward in a more thoughtful way and trigger the NEPA process.
With regard to your last question, I think that's an appropriate question for Mr. Collier and the Pebble Partnership. But keep in mind that the EPA has said, as long as the 404 process is stopped now, they could not, no one could issue a permit until that is resolved, and that is a legal issue that's ongoing. With regard to the request from Alaska Natives, we talked to Alaska Natives that were not in favor of Pebble, and we talked to Alaska Natives that were very much in favor of Pebble. All we are saying is the NEPA process is the fairest way to bring together all those people, all those different views, and all the various agencies that need to be involved in this. Secondly, there one of the very troubling aspects of the Phil North emails and the missing piece here, we know that, in fact, the EPA IG called the possible misuse of position was his coordination with anti-Pebble mine groups when he is an EPA federal employee, supposedly even-handed looking at this process.
Further questions? Seeing none. Ms. Butler, did you have a statement to make?
I do not have a statement. If I could just add very briefly
to
that last question, though. With regard to the process of the permit NEPA application, now, the one thing that I'm sure everyone here is very well familiar with is that until a permit is actually issued and it's gone through that process, there can't be a shovel put in the ground. So although this, you know, the EPA stepped in and made this 404C preemptive action, nothing was going to be done at that time whether or not they stepped in or not. There still has to be a permit application filed. There still has to be a permit granted. And the EPA is not relinquishing its 404C right by not acting prior to a permit application being filed. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Ms. Butler. I seem to recall a mine that was actually permitted and under development, actually working mine that was that permit was withdrawn by the EPA a few years ago in West Virginia, I'm thinking. So a permit being issued by the EPA is certainly no guarantee either. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. General Ralston, I certainly appreciate your service to our country and that of Secretary Cohen's. But I got to say, this is a report that criticizes the EPA for process that was paid for by the Pebble Partnership and amounts that your organization refuses to disclose that was prepared behind closed doors with zero transparency, with 60 anonymous sources that you refuse to disclose, a preliminary report that was not released for public review before disclosure, that was not released to those anonymous 60 individuals who participated in the report and was not peer-reviewed. This report does not deal with scientific issues. It does not deal with legal issues. As for me personally, I don't give this report very much credibility. It's an opinion. I respect your right to that opinion. It's a paid opinion by Pebble Partnership. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Nagyuk.
I've been involved in, I used to work for BLM for 6 years. And I have known federal government employees who have preconceived notions of keeping any kind of development away as best as they can. This is within the federal government. And so, I have, they have no regard in some cases of following the rules and the laws of the United States. These are employees of the federal government. And so, when I hear things like this, it brings back some of the things that I went through. And so, I've lived through this before, and I've seen other agencies, especially in places where there should be, there's laws made or laws passed that there should be an opportunity for Native organizations and corporations to do what they can in their own land. But the federal government stated to organizations, departments have made it hard for those people who own land and federal lands to do not do, they restrict them to develop their own lands. And I've talked about this for a long time, especially in Anwar. And that's, you know, I was born there, and I know it's an issue that's divided people there also. But the processes have never been followed according to the rule of law. And so that really, when I hear things like this, you know, it just brings back memories. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Nagyak, for your comments. Senator Coghill, did you have some additional comments?
Sure.
I will, before you begin, it is my intention to adjourn this aspect of the meeting in about 5 minutes because we have another EPA issue to address, and that has to do with water as well. Senator Coghill.
Well, I wanted to echo the remarks of the senator to my right that I appreciate the public service, General Ralston, and I appreciate the work that you all have done here. I spent 5 years in the Air Force, and I got to E5, so you scare me.
You shouldn't be scared. Thank you for your service.
So, but what I will say is that I know that it was contracted by a group of people to give you the broadest independence you can have, and this public report is just exactly that. It's what you found on an independent search. Unfortunately, the very thing that he is charging you with, that's what the EPA is doing. It is not a peer-reviewed, private, no meetings held, no public review, privately, behind the scenes, in dark rooms deal, which I find very, very troubling. And so, at least with you, you were paid to go look for some answers. And you came back with some answers, and you described very well, I thought, your non-biased approach to it and how you were independent. That has not been given to us by our own federal government, for which I'm really sorry to say. So I find it very troubling that the very thing that you've been charged with is the very thing that our government is in fact doing. And I appreciate you bringing it to light and bringing to light some of the places that have yet to be brought to light. And unfortunately, whether Congress or the courts will get to deal with it, my guess is it's going to be a long road. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Further questions? We probably have time for one more, if anyone has one. All right, seeing none. The rhetorical question was asked earlier, why are we here? We're here because, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the meeting, the state deals with a lot of federal regulations. I neglected to mention what the U.S. Forest Service does with our Endangered Species Act findings that prohibit much of the development in our state. We talked about the Eisenbeck Road, waters of the U.S., clean air, prohibiting our coal development. So we have a lot of reason to be here discussing the fairness of the regulatory process of the federal government. So, General Ralston, thank you very much for being here. Ms. Butler, thank you for your presentation. At this time, I also want to thank the House members who have been here from House Resources. Co-Chairs Nagyak and Tallarico, thank you for bringing your committee. Representative Seaton, Representative Josephson, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnson, Representative Herron, thank you for attending today and participating in this discussion. So at this time, I will adjourn this part of the meeting so that we can prepare for the second half of the Senate Resources Committee. We are adjourned.
So 2 p.m.,
we
were right in the midst of a presentation by Mr. Alper, and he will come back. Today is Monday, March 7, 2016. Good evening, welcome back, and let the record show that the House Resources Committee will be convened at 6:02 p.m. present, Representative Josephson, Representative Heron, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative, let me see, Olson, my fellow co-chair, Representative Tara Wicker, myself, and Representative Johnson is present also, and Representative Hucker has been excused. He was excused all day, so I didn't say that earlier. Let the record reflect we have people here to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello, Martha from House Records. Hello to Matt from Mill.io. Welcome back to Department of Revenue's Tax Director Ken Alford. Let's continue the presentation on House Bill 247. I believe we're on slide number 48. Mr. Alford, please slow down in presenting. We have to finish, and thank you in advance for naming. Did I just write that? presenting.
Just take your time.
thank you in advance for naming the slide you are discussing with us. We will stop at 7:30 p.m. this evening, and hopefully Mr. Apple can complete the presentation by that time. Then we will start on the section analysis tomorrow. I believe we left off on section 18 back on February 12th. And Commissioner of Revenue is here, Randy. Commissioner Halfbeck, sorry, and he's in the back. Thank you for attending, sir. Okay, welcome back, Mr. Alford. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record, and thank you for having us back. My name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. With me is Dan Stickle, the Assistant Chief Economist at the Tax Division. When we left this afternoon, we were on slide 48. slides number 47 through 50, in many ways, paralleled slides number 43 through 46. They were all status quo slides looking at the assumptions of a new oil field being developed in Cook Inlet. The main difference, the only difference between the two, is what exactly happens in 2022 when the current tax caps are scheduled to sunset, to be self-repealed in existing law. So the first set of slides, which showed the taxes that would be paid under the underlying tax regime, 35% net profits tax, showed one set of answers. This is another set of answers looking at what would happen if the Cook Inlet caps were extended indefinitely. And thus, if you look at this slide, the $60 slide, you see zero production tax being paid because the statutory production tax on oil in Cook Inlet today is zero, which is based upon the conditions that were in place when PPT passed in the year 2006. Those are the old ELF multipliers. So you can see that in a zero tax scenario, it's quite robust for the producers, but at $60 oil, you see a negative state NPV. Negative $37 million. We do get money from royalty, we do have eventually positive cash flow, but not enough to compensate the state for the credit cost up front, especially without any back-end production tax revenue. So that's where we were on slide 48, putting in context 47 was the beginning of this conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, when we're talking about this slide here with the total annual losses, the middle section in the life cycle table down there, that's including all royalty and all property tax, not the state's portion that it comes to the general fund. In other words, 25% of a minimum of 25% of the royalty has to go to the permanent fund, so that's not available for the general fund. And the property tax split about half in Cook Inlet. Is that correct? So,
through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'm going to answer what I believe it to be, and I'm going to ask Ms. Niehaus, who's on the line, to confirm just to make certain. What I believe these numbers include is the non-permanent fund share of the royalty, meaning the general fund portion of royalty, 75%. And I'm fairly certain that it includes only the state's portion of property taxes. meaning the portion that's shared with municipalities is not included in this analysis. So this is the state's unrestricted general fund cash flow as a as an isolated data set. Sherry, are you there?
Yes, I'm here through the chair, Representative Seaton. I believe that actually the state revenue in this case does include the amount that would go to the permanent fund. There was no, I believe if we were only representing the revenue that goes to the general fund, it would be called GFUR, General Fund Unrestricted Revenues. So my understanding is this is state revenues only, so it would not include the amount that would go to the municipality for the property tax, but it does include the amount that would go to the permanent fund.
And
go ahead,
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, maybe we can get that verified and get back to us on that, just so that we're understanding exactly what it has in the end. But that's fine for now.
Yeah. Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Seaton, and part of the confusion, and thank you, Sherry, for correcting me, is we did the analysis both ways for Representative Seaton's request. We had a broader set of analysis that with different cash flows that he asked for, so I wasn't sure which one survived to this version that we're doing for the committee. So with all that in mind, I'm about to step forward to slide number 49, which is the $80 oil scenario. Once again, there is no production tax. There's the royalty. The state is now with a positive number, $63 million. Quite possibly, if you're looking at general fund only, that might go back to being a negative number. We'd have to find that out. And then the producer's cash flow discounted is relatively robust at $612 million is the value of their discounted cash flow. Generally speaking, there's not a lot of difference in the shapes of the curves for 47 versus 8 versus 9. It's just a matter of the magnitude of them tied to the different prices of oil.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alper, when I look at these sheets, my eyes continually focus on the your comparison with the opportunity lost, I guess, which is what you're trying to reflect in the state NPV 6.15%. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when we say state NPV 6.15%, yes, it's the value of the what we call a discounted cash flow. A dollar received to next year is 6.15% less valuable than a dollar we receive this year. A dollar received 2 years from now would be 6.15% times 6.15% less valuable. So the deeper you get into the future, the less the money is worth to us. That's right. That's the nature of that.
Follow up, if I may. So to compare, to set that the NPV aside and compare an apple to an apple, it would be $337 million on this slide to $1.4 billion about, right? $1.385 billion. Those would be that'd be the comparison.
If the cash flow, the money in, money out, without worrying about time, our $337 million compares with the producer's $1.385 billion.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And in terms of the time value of money, our 63 compares to their 612.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on, as in all of these models, it seems the forecast price falls somewhere in between the $60 and the $80 number. So the state's NPV is almost exactly zero, $14 million, with a data set this large is essentially a rounding error, and the producer's positive value of $481 million. Now this is, as I said earlier, a relatively unlikely scenario of the status quo. It presumes that the legislature chooses to indefinitely extend the existing caps on cook inlet taxes without making any other changes to the tax and credit regime in cook inlet.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on that again?
All right. Thank you. When we recessed at 3:15 or so, I asked you about that, and you said it's unlikely. Wouldn't the arguments, that is, it's unlikely that we would extend them beyond 2022, wouldn't the arguments we've heard be the same sort of arguments, short of having a gas line, you know, near the city gate coming down from the North Slope? In which case, I think we might logically say, what are we doing with Cook Inlet at this point? But why would the arguments be any different? Couldn't they be even more of what we heard, and I don't mean to suggest I heard some things that were very compelling. But why would those arguments be different?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, to my knowledge, no one is actively asking for extension of the Cook Inlet tax caps right now. There are certainly many proponents to keeping the tax credit regime in place the way that it is. We heard that in public testimony and in invited testimony, last week, large amounts of it. Those were left in place for 15 years. That's a very long time. A production tax of zero is hard to justify over the long term, unless we simply didn't have a production tax. That would be a very different thing. We do have a production tax on the books that pays out a lot of credits, thus leaving us in, if you look at the red bars here, at the forecasted price, the state is spending $347 million on tax credits of various sorts to the owners of that field without any production tax. As a diligent sovereign, as an entity desiring to balance the budget and do all the many things that the Alaskan state government needs to do, I have a hard time imagining a justification for that over the indefinite long term.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move ahead now to the first slide that looks at the impact of House Bill 247. We're looking at now the $25 million per company cap, which is clearly apparent in the red bars in the upper left-hand corner. You could see the reimbursements right at that $25 million number for several years before they reduce and the state gets positive cash flow from the production tax. Even with that, at $40 oil, it's not really making a lot of money for anybody. The taxes in question is enough to provide positive cash flow to the state, $159 million worth of production taxes, discounted cash flow of negative $19 million. Now, more interestingly, the state's total cash flow, including apparently permanent fund royalties, creates a positive net present value of $108 million. Keep in mind, just as one might say, and I made the argument a few minutes ago, that the maintain the tax caps forever scenario is too low, this tax regime for Cook Inlet is almost certainly too high. This is a 35% net profits tax without any sort of comparable benefit like the per barrel credit that exists on the North Slope, without any sort of new oil GVR type benefit that exists on the North Slope. So we have just the 35% net tax, and you're seeing with that, certainly the state has a positive present value, and once you add up the royalty, the producers are losing money at $40 oil. I'd like to skip ahead to slide number 52, which has the $60 scenario, and you could see now that even at $60 oil, even with this relatively onerous production tax regime and the cutting off of the credits at $25 million, this is actually a money-making field for the producers. They have a positive present value of $80 million. That's the bottom line there, the producer's cash flow. Meanwhile, the state has a value of $121 million discounted on the production tax, or $331 million on the totality of state revenue. And once again, you can see here the quite clean cutoff at $25 million per year of the tax credits themselves. What I'm going to do, and I hate jumping around, and I'm going to pause while I do it, I just want to look at, so if you look at the state's numbers here, I'm going to write them down on a scrap of paper, 121 and 331, and the producers of 80, that's with SB 247 in place at $60, with the tax caps expiring. I'm going to go back eight slides to slide number 44, where you can see that the state gained about $170 million on the production tax, or about $170 million in present value, and the producers lost about $120 million in their cash flow in the changes envisioned by House Bill 247. That's primarily from the moving the cash flow around of the $25 million per year cap on the refunded tax credits. So, and all this jumping around, I know it's confusing, and I'm going to stop doing it right now, because when we get to the end of the presentation, which I'm
surprisingly close to, you'll see there are a couple of summary tables that bring all of this data on two slides, and we'll be able to review all of it at the same time. So I'm jumping back ahead the eight slides that I was on slide number 52, which was the tax caps expiring $60 scenario. I'm moving ahead now to the $80 oil. Tax caps expiring at 80, slide number 53, and seeing how the state gets a pretty robust cash flow from the production tax now, that high production tax. The state gets an excellent cash flow from the from their total take, and the producers are seeing a value also of $278 million in discounted value. So that's certainly, as the price of oil gets higher, of course, everyone does better across the board. And to be clear here, our cost profiles and all of the other assumptions stay the same as the price of oil moves around. So we're purely seeing the impact of the changes in the price of oil.
Mr. Chair, I'm used to being in a queue, but because there isn't one, I'll just get in at the head of the line, if I may. Through the chair, Mr. Alper, are you saying that future legislature, whatever that is, the 33rd legislature or something, I don't know, would need to revisit, obviously, this tax before 2022 or in 2022, that with the expiration of it, if 247 were to pass, those are a couple serious caveats, that this arguably is too favorable to the state? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Before you answer, would you address the chair when you have a question?
Yes.
Please?
Yes, I think.
Go ahead, sir.
Certainly, and through the chair, Representative Josephson, the expiration of the tax caps in 2022 is a pending issue before the legislature, with or without the passage of tax credit reform this year. My opinion is only worth what my opinion is worth, but yes, I believe that production tax is likely too generous and frankly unstable for Cook Inlet, given its constraints, and that price, that tax system remains, would be the same tax system for gas as well, 35% of net profits without any offsets or per barrel credits or anything of the like. That's not, it wasn't so much left there to be the tax system, it was left there because the previous legislature, when looking to reform North Slope taxes, didn't need to worry about it yet because it was enough years off in the future. It was sort of kicked down the can for it. The can is kicked down the road for a future day. We are getting a little bit closer to that day, but we're still, you know, here we are in the tail end of the 29th legislature. This is a problem that, yeah, you're correct, might not need to be addressed until the 32nd legislature in the 2021 session. But what Mr. Meyer testified to, and I'm inclined to agree with him, is that industry finds instability in our system in a couple of different places. First off, of course, that we have big, giant deficits, and therefore they don't know what our government's going to look like in a year or two. Secondly, and more importantly in the context here, they see our extensive negative cash flow from the tax credit system. We're spending hundreds of millions of dollars that are more than the amount of production tax revenue coming in, and they are presuming on a certain level at least that some sort of reform is going to be made, and they're building that into their assumptions, that instability. And the third instability is the sunsetting of the tax caps. They don't know what the fiscal system is going to be for the majority of the life cycle of any decision that they might make now. If any investment decision made now or soon is a multi-year decision, and they don't know what the tax is going to be for the tail end of it. So if it were possible, if we had the time and the inclination, I would be happy to work with the committee to create a new Cook Inlet oil and gas tax system. It might be beyond the scope of this committee's interest in this session's capacity for new heavy lifting in the field of oil and gas, but I leave that to you and to the rest of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that's the $80 tax caps expiring scenario on slide 53. Slide 54, with the forecast prices again going up from $50 now, $56 next year, up into the 70s and stabilizing into the 70s without considering inflation, we see the state with positives on the production tax, higher positives on the overall take, and the producers with a positive value, $183 million on the field. When you can these fields, it's interesting to see their cash flows. They drop off quite rapidly once you get past peak production, and that's Well, just because of the nature of any large oil field. And this is, these peak at 17,000 barrels a day of production, but it declines rapidly after that peak. So slide number 55, this is the tax caps extended with the impact of House Bill 247. So you can see now, instead of the bigger spike of negative credit cash flow that we saw eight slides earlier, we see the capped at the $25 million per year, and the sum total is $142 million worth of tax credits going out the door. The other main change, which I should have mentioned a few minutes ago, through the passage of House Bill 247 is, of course, the repeal of the Cook Inlet well lease expenditure and qualified capital expenditure credit. So what we're really seeing here is the state's only paying 25% of costs through the development phase, through the net operating loss credit, as opposed to the 50 to 60% that we're currently paying. So that cuts the state's cash obligations more than in half, which tremendously helps the state's bottom line. Even with that, at $40 a barrel, we're losing money, of course, on the production tax, because there is no production tax, and we're barely making money on the total state take. The producer portion of it is also losing money, as they were with status quo. But interestingly, the difference in these numbers, and we'll see them in the final, are about the same between the two scenarios of tax system, the no tax and the underlying tax, as there is between the before and the after with the passage of this bill. You know, the order of magnitude, it's about the same, and we'll see that when we get to the summary slides. Moving on to slide 56, this is closer to the to a break-even price for everyone, $60 oil. At $60 oil, we're now paying $134 million in credits, so with a negative discounted value of negative $97 million, but the state gets a decent return on the rest of the take, so therefore we have $126 million in total state take, and a larger number for the producers. They're doing better at $214 million, and as far as value to the company. I'm going to move quickly to 57 and see the same kind of numbers, and it's unfortunate that the scale jumps. I'm going to quick go back from 56 to 57. Look quickly at the upper right-hand corner. It looks like the numbers just got smaller, but that's because the top of this chart on slide 56 is at $50 million, but the top of the chart on slide 57 is $100 million. So, in fact, this total state take is coming in at close to $80 million a year in the peak years of the project. And at $80 oil, the total state take discounted value is $225 million. We're still, of course, in a negative number. If the tax caps are extended, the production tax is never going to be a positive number, of course. If we spend any money on credits 1 year, that becomes a negative money for the entirety of the calculation, because there's never a positive number to offset against. And then, of course, the producers at $496 million in cash flow, that's their discounted price at $80 oil, which people are waiting for. At the forecasted price, again, the state does pretty well. The producers do better. With the tax caps extended, that's a very generous regime to industry. And what I'd really like to do, having put all this exotic graphics before you, is to go to the summary slides 59 and 60. 60 and 61. What we have on slide 60 here is all of the scenarios from the North Slope on a single piece of paper, which might make it easier to have a conversation. And then the subsequent slide, 61, will be the Cook Inlet summary. So what do we have before us here? I showed 20 different scenarios, 20 different slides with North Slope modeling. The first eight were based on the idea of a smaller field, a 50 million barrel field. And you can see as you look down this chart, you have the status quo at the four different oil prices, and then the House Bill 247 scenarios at the four different oil prices. And you can see each of the metrics that we were looking at, the major metrics anyway, in the summary corner of each slide, the total credits paid, the net of production tax credits minus eventual taxation, and then the discounted value of that cash flow. The same analysis done for total state take, total gain, net gain, and net present value, and then finally the producer's cash flow, positive or negative, and then their discounted value. And you know, one thing you can see across the board, which I alluded to several times, for the producers, all of the $40 scenarios are losers for them, no matter what. The $60 scenarios are winners for the smaller field, even with the changes envisioned by House Bill 247. The changes made by 247 do turn the large field from a small gain to a loss, with the main reason for that being the much larger comparable benefit of the cap of $25 million a year on how much credits we're prepared to purchase. That's a much bigger deal for a much bigger field. So you see that there on the right. The 12 scenarios that we did for the larger oil field, the 750 million barrel field, are there because we have two different so-called after scenarios. One of them where the companies get the $25 million, and the second set, the last four scenarios on this page, are the circumstance where a very large company with more than $10 billion in revenue would be completely excluded from being able to get state cash rebates. But interestingly there, if you just look over to the right at the, say, the producer impact, at $80 oil, at the $7.50 there they are at 22.16, and that's the number, I'll sort of shine it at the wall there. That's the producer's net present value at $80 oil of the status quo. That drops to $1.4 billion if they get $25 million a year from us, but only by another $60 million less than that for getting none. So there's far more impact done from the reduction to the $25 million than there is the further reduction to the zero. So I might have been wise to start with these slides rather than finish with them, because they take a lot of information and boil it down to put it on a single paper. I think this does a good job of laying out all of the work that we did in trying to look at different scenarios, and once again, we're prepared to do any others that the committee might request. If there aren't questions on 60, I'm going to jump ahead to 61. Now, 61 has 16 scenarios. We only looked at the smaller field because we don't anticipate elephant fields in Cook Inlet, but we're looking at the two different tax regimes. With the third column, where the question is, do the tax caps sunset, yes and no, you could see the impact that in both state take and in producer take from those different scenarios. So here we are with, for example, at $80 oil, the status quo with the tax cap sunsetting, the producer's present value drops from 396 to 278. They lose about $118 million in present value. Presuming that the tax cap sunset, if the tax caps are extended, they're losing about 120. So similar numbers, but the increment between the tax cap sunsetting and not within the status quo is actually bigger. It's over $200 million benefit to the company of extending the tax caps within the status quo, mm-hmm. and over $200 million benefit from the company from extending the tax caps within the HB 247 scenario. So I guess the argument that I'm making with that is the credit changes, while material, are smaller in magnitude than any other decisions that this or a future legislature will make about the tax regime itself that impacts production in Cook Inlet. Another thing I want to mention, after our hearing, I spoke to the people who were working on the modeling, the Sherry who's on the phone. We would like to put together some gas field life cycle modeling. We think we could do it in fairly short order. We can provide slides to the committee. We don't need to be scheduled again. Now that you're all more or less familiar with the format, you don't need me necessarily sitting here walking you through it, but we're happy to provide some extra slides to look at that. And then Representative Olson asked me after the hearing if we had other scenarios. One thing we've done on the North Slope side is look at, for the large field, the 750 million barrel field, what would the impact be if it were in a high royalty location, if it were in a part of the state where they were paying the 1/6 rather than the 1/8 royalty. And with that higher royalty, although we gain money on the royalty side, we do lose money on the production tax side because of the way Senate Bill 21 is constructed, that the gross value reduction, the so-called new oil benefit, increases from a 20% benefit to a 30% benefit if the entirety of a field is at the high royalty level. So The bottom line numbers are about the same, frankly, but we'll provide the slides with, although it's more royalty and less production tax. And
Ken, can you do a table similar to the summary table on Cook Inlet for the interior, for Middle Earth, everything that we have going on in Fairbanks, with basically the same columns?
And through the chair, Representative Olson, yes. I'm saying yes before I check with our staff, so I'm pretty sure yes. The Middle Earth has its own statutory tax caps that I believe are good until 2027. So we have a little bit more certainty for the short and medium term as to what the tax is going to be. They are locked in at 4% of gross value through, I believe, 2027. So we should be able to do that. The template field, if there is such a thing, is what Doran is talking about for developing in the Monona area, I would imagine. If that's acceptable to you, Representative Olson, then we would be happy to do some modeling of that.
Hello? I assume we have tax credits for the Fairbanks LNG storage facility. maybe include that. How about the in-state refinery up north?
Yeah, these, through the chair, Representative Olson, these are hard credits to build into project level modeling. The Fairbanks utility, the Fairbanks regional project, is going to benefit from the storage tank credit. That's a comparable credit to what was received by CINSA in the Cook Inlet storage. But I don't know where the refinery credits can be built into that. I don't know enough about the local utilities and needs as to where that might play into the project itself. But if you'd like to talk to us about that afterwards, I'm to help guide the direction as to how to run this modeling.
Hello?
I'm fine up.
Yeah, I think we're on the same page. That's why I asked the question. But when they expire. Thanks. I know it's a lot of work, but I think it'll all help us get our hands around it.
There's through the chair, Representative Olson, not that I want to give you a reading assignment. We did three long presentations to the Senate Working Group in the fall, one of them dedicated to Cook Inlet, one of them to North Slope, and one dedicated to Middle Earth credits. Those give a pretty good overview of how they're structured, how they've been used, what the benefits are, what the sunsets are. So I'll send you, when I get back to the office, the links to all of those, and then just so you can go through it at your wish as a background document, and then we'll do some modeling on a theoretical future project.
Well, perhaps if they could go to the chairs and not me.
Without question, Representative Olson.
Thank you,
the chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Following up on Representative Olson's modeling, can you also make sure that we get some that are private royalty or on private land, where and what we're providing? There are differences in taxes and minimum taxes and those kind of things as well. So, but I think it'd be very helpful to us to know what our cash flow is on those where we don't receive any royalty.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, we provided to the committee earlier, might have been today, a copy of an analysis we did for another the other body, just showing what are the royalty breakdowns for different categories of land. Federal land in NPRA, federal land in NAMLA are different, what private royalty looks like and all of that. So that will be shared with the committee soon. We would like to run some scenarios. I believe I mentioned it. Doran's first project works out great because it's on state land, but their second project, which is on their own private land, would have a very different cash flow to the state, and it's worth looking at those. We might not get into the multiple variations and different price scenarios, but maybe a few less options for each possible scenario. I don't want to inundate the committee with another 50 slides, but I think that would be very helpful to provide that sort of modeling, and we will do so. Yeah.
Thanks.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that we frequently hear sort of, in evaluating these different tax structures is not having winners and losers and sort of things, that favor one company size over another or development opportunity. And so it's just more kind of a generic question, but this 247 kind of moves away from some of the other credits to net operating loss sort of structurally, but keeps 35% for North Slope and 25% for Cook Inlet. And I just wonder if there's reasoning beyond what I may be thinking as to why that stayed like that, and if you considered doing the same for both areas at any point, and why that would, you know, be good or bad.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the 35% operating loss credit on the North Slope came along for the ride with the 35% base tax rate in Senate Bill 21. Mm-hmm. That change was only applied to the North Slope. However, the portion of the tax code that talks about the base rate didn't parse it out. It actually put that 35 number in statute. That's why we have this 35% tax credit, tax rate in Cook Inlet. It would certainly be possible to put in a 35% operating loss credit without a terribly complicated amendment that would increase the state's cost, the state's liability. A part of the rationale for the higher operating loss credit on the North Slope is that the companies actually are paying those taxes. So there's some measure of a playing field leveler in play here. With you use the example of a major producer. If a major producer spends one more dollar on some new field, they reduce their taxable income, and therefore they save 35 cents on their taxes. Regardless of the per barrel credit, they do get the tax savings is at the marginal rate of 35%, so we offer a 35% operating loss credit to the new guy, to the person who doesn't have profits. Up until such time as the incumbent producer in Cook Inlet is actually paying taxes, there isn't really a playing field to level. We don't need to give a higher benefit to the person on their loss credits to make them equitable with the person with the taxpayer if the taxpayer's effective rate is zero for the next 5 years. But at such time as there is a new Cook Inlet tax regime, it seems to me that a new Cook Inlet operating loss credit would be an important component of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Halpert. Of course, the other factor following up on Representative Tarr's question is the whole issue of our need for natural gas in South Central. And that's a more parity with the North Slope.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is an excellent point. Certainly there remains, although not as overwhelming or as imminent as it might have been a few years ago, some sense of gas anxiety, supply anxiety for the Cook Inlet utilities. You heard that from them. If we need to provide a higher level of benefit to keep that gas being produced, especially in a world where we are proposing eliminating the drilling credits, it's a reasonable argument to say that 35% as a sort of a compromise number going forward might be viable. Now, we're not certainly proposing that, and I'm not in a position to offer that, but while going from 50, 60 to 25, going to 35 might certainly blunt the impact.
Senator Jane Wilson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, have you done any models on the Agrium bill and the impact of the potential impact of the credit that's built within it?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, I appreciate your asking that. I did write the Department of Revenue's fiscal note for that bill and the bill analysis for the governor. I'm fairly familiar with the provisions and the economics embedded in that bill. It's an interesting concept, and it has a lot of upside for the state without that much downside, simply because there's no upfront cash expended. It's very different as envisioned to any of the tech credits that we're looking to reform here, in that it would require the producer, Agrium, to do all the work and make the commitment to redevelop their facility and then begin purchasing large amounts of gas and then earn a profit and start having a corporate income tax obligation. And then any credit they earned through House Bill 100 would be an offset against their corporate income tax liability. And what that bill could do potentially is provide the security for gas suppliers to go and drill and develop new fields that would, for example, we use the example of Fury. Fury is they may have made a large discovery. We really don't know. There's been conflicting information in the press. They've signed some relatively small sales contracts. But if, in fact, they're sitting on a large resource, they would like to be able to develop it, but they're not going to do that unless they have a way to sell it. Something like a rebuilt Agrium facility might go a long way towards giving them the security they need to do that. And in that case, it would, frankly, make it easier to come in and modify some of the Cook Inlet tax credits because there would be a lot less supply anxiety going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that something the administration might support?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, I'm not in a position to speak for the administration. I don't know if the governor has taken a position on House Bill 100. I did my best to analyze it and model it as dispassionately as I could and talk about the potential benefits. In some ways, it's a hard year without a tax credit bill. You know, we have negative cash flow to the state. We're losing money, big deficits. And we're here before you with a bill to reduce the state's spending on tax credits by several hundred million dollars. So it's hard to say, oh, but we want to add this other one. However, there's a lot of argument to be made for targeted, smaller, very focused credits, which have a really good multiplier for the state's economics.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Kind of getting back to the North Slope. I mean the Cook Inlet for a minute. You know, our consultants told us that $5 to $7 MCF was sufficient gas price to develop even the most expensive gas around the world. And so it seems that anything that we do with credits, of course, are oil and gas undifferentiated in Cook Inlet. So those credits aren't needed for gas production in almost every scenario. So if we continue to pay the credits in Cook Inlet and we're getting the multiple of what we got, the 8,000 barrels a day, or even if we go up and get twice that much, we're still in the annual credit range of $200 to $400 million. It's $68 to $136 per barrel is the effective amount that we're subsidizing for that, even if some of the companies are drilling for gas but the credits weren't needed to get that drilling. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, how do we go through and separate oil from gas, or can we, with the combined drilling costs and combined capital costs equation that we have? Do we have any mechanism in front of us for doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the $136 figure, I just want to clarify where that came from, and that was the analysis that you did. And if you take the 8,000 barrels a day of increased oil production that we've seen in Cook Inlet in the last few years and divide that among the $400 million that we spent on credits last year, that works out to about $136 per incremental barrel over the course of the year. Obviously, that doesn't divide the benefit with the gas and all of that, but I mean, it's a very large number, but it's not, as large as it is, it's not outrageous, because the numbers are real. We did spend $400 million. As for dividing costs between oil and gas, that's always a complicated one. It's one that I'm probably going to let Dan speak to in a minute, because he's worked at the Department of Revenue longer than I have. One of the issues that was before the body when there was a decoupling bill, spent a lot of time in this committee in 2010, was how to adequately separate costs between oil and gas. It's easier when you're, and maybe the example in your district, the Blue Crest project, might be easier than most, just because they've got a very different and distinct drilling location for their oil project versus their gas project, even though the resources themselves are in the same part of the earth, they're vertical above each other. But I think that's more the exception than the rule. So, Dan, can you speak to our ability to separate oil and gas expenditures?
Sure. Dan Stickle, Assistant Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue, and Representative Seaton through the chair. My understanding is currently, if you have a unit within Cook Inlet that would produce both oil and gas, that those commingled costs would be separated based on the gross value of point of production of the oil versus the gas. So if 60% of your value came from oil, then you'd attribute 60% of the costs to the oil. And that would, of course, be before calculating your tax that you'd apply the zero tax ceiling for oil to and the 17.7 cents per MCF ceiling for gas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'm trying to figure out if we've got a new field, all the investments up front, and the credits are earned up front, and production comes later, and that can vary by how much gas, how much oil. I mean, it's not like it's always a 50-50 cut or a 75-25 cut. So I'm trying to figure out, does that mean that if you were working on that kind of a scheme, you would go back and recover some credits from someone if they had more gas than oil, if you weren't giving credits for gas because the price is adequate to support a gas development, or how? I don't recall the conversation of how we got into it and cooked in it as far as decoupling.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the decoupling bill ended up with a formula tied to, I believe it was gross value at the point of production. So it was, it's inartful and it's inexact, and it would be possible to a certain extent to do a more comprehensive separation, although it would be a workload within the department. I think the question you're really asking is, could we establish a different level of credit support for oil versus gas? And I think we could, although I'd definitely need to check with a few people over what some of the hurdles and pitfalls to that might be. Because ultimately, if you go back to the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, the desire was to get a big benefit to make sure people found enough gas to keep the lights on. And as it turns out from our own analysis, a third or so of that money got spent on oil. That might not have been necessary to get the oil developed, because the oil was had a more stable market and it wasn't as much of a life or death situation. So if we wanted to do two different things for oil versus gas, we'd have to look at how to implement it, but I believe it could be done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else?
Just one comment. I think oil is an issue in parts of Cook Inlet, particularly to Tesoro, who used to get all their oil in Cook Inlet. Now they're bringing it around from Valdez or elsewhere because there is not an adequate supply.
Yeah. Anybody else? Thank you very much, Mr. Alper. Are there any other committee questions or comments? We'll stop for today, and we'll meet tomorrow at 1 p.m. to continue our work on House Bill 247. Thank you, Mr. Alper, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you for taking
We're adjourned at 6:51.